the 2000 presidential election. A long night. Most of us won't forget.
We are now able to make a projection in the state of Florida. ABC News projects that Al Gore wins the state of Florida in its 25 electoral votes.
But we've just pulled back the big 25 from Florida.
Al Gore trailing the president-elect in the state that proved to be pivotal by 565 votes.
Some
That's
votes.
Not even a wide spot in the road.
There are still some votes that have not been counted.
What if this goes the other way?
In the end, the way George W. Bush beat Al Gore hadn't happened since 1888, when Benjamin Harrison beat the incumbent president, Grover Cleveland. In both cases, the winner did not collect the most popular votes, but he did collect the most Electoral College votes. The Electoral College. It's how the U.S. elects its president, but how many of its citizens know what it is and how it works?
What is the Electoral College?
I have no idea.
I'll tell you, I don't know.
I have no idea.
I don't know. I really don't know.
What do you think it might be? Have any idea?
A college to do something with elections.
Isn't there like senators voting for it? I'm not sure how it works.
Isn't it where like it's how many points your state's worth or something like that? How many votes? Yeah, in the election. If the candidate wins your state over, they get so many points.
Do you think you know what the Electoral College is?
I think I know, but I'm not sure.
Well, give it a shot.
The Electoral College is a vote that was set up depending on the population of each state. And each state has so many votes that are given to the presidential candidate state-wise. So I think that's what it is.
Do you know what it is?
Yes.
What is it?
It's a bunch of rich guys messing around with the rest of us.
Do you know what the Electoral College is?
Yes. It's a college in Albuquerque.
It is. And do you know anybody who goes there?
Yes.
Who do you know?
My dad.
Now, if you could ask an expert any question you wanted to ask about the Electoral College, what would it be?
What it is? Why do we have it?
Does it really work?
I'm Kathleen Sabo. The Electoral College. How did we get it? And should we keep it? Some argue yes, others say no. We'll tackle some of the many questions on today's special program. The Electoral College. Democracy gained or lost? With me is John Harwood, Chief Washington Correspondent for CNBC and a writer for the New York Times. I'm also joined by Professor Frederick Schauer. He is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. He's a leading expert on the First Amendment, constitutional law, and legal philosophy, who taught at Harvard University for many years. Welcome to both of you.
Great to be
here. Delighted to be here.
And let's start with some basics. John Harwood, in a nutshell, what is the Electoral College and how does it work?
In a nutshell, it's an indirect way by which the American people select their president. The founders didn't want to go, when they framed the Constitution, didn't want to go to direct popular vote of presidents. And they came up with this system. And I believe the words Electoral College don't actually appear in the Constitution. But they came up with this system by which states would choose electors who would then vote for president. And the way it is worked out in practice is that in 48 of the 50 states, if a majority of voters vote for one candidate or the other, it's a winner-take-all system, and the candidate gets that state's electoral votes. Two exceptions, Maine and Nebraska, which have alternative methods of apportioning their votes depending on who does well in the state.
Okay, and how many total electoral votes are out there?
There are 538 electoral votes. There's one awarded for each member of the House of Representatives, one for each member of the Senate, and then there are three electoral votes for the District of Columbia, which doesn't have representation in Congress.
Okay, and how many votes are needed to actually win the Electoral College vote and gain the presidency?
The magic number is 270. And that's what both sides are shooting for this time.
Fred Schauer, what are the origins of the Electoral College and why do we still have it around?
The origins are complex. At its most basic level, the Electoral College arose out of a constitution that itself was the successor to the much looser Union of States under the Articles of Confederation. So the Constitution was drafted and the Electoral College emerged under a system in which the states as states were thought of as independent and very important entities, perhaps not quite as important as countries in the United Nations or the European Union, but the analogy is an important one because it suggests, as with the UN and as with the European Union, that there was a view at the time that states as entities ought to be entitled to representation in the election of a president, just as states as entities are entitled to representation, frequently disproportionate to their population, in the Senate of the United States. So part of the formal structural origin was to give a role to the states and therefore to give a relatively equal role in part to the states as states, but tempered by the recognition of the fact that some states were much larger than others. So the Electoral College is in that sense a structural compromise between the role of population and the role of states as states. In fact, a fair amount of recent evidence, some of it developed by my colleague Alex Kasar, suggests that from the beginning and certainly in its continuation, race played a role as well, that it was less of a debate at the beginning between large and small and more between North and South, and that the Electoral College, both in its origins and its and in its continuation for much but not all of the 20th century, had a fair amount to do with the politics of race.
There have been a number of interesting results involving the Electoral College, the most recent of which, akin to the 1888 contest between the incumbent Grover Cleveland and the challenger Benjamin Harrison, is the 2000 election, when then-Vice President Al Gore won the popular vote, but his opponent, then Texas Governor George W. Bush, gained enough Electoral College votes to win the presidency. John, just in pure numbers, how did this happen?
Well, because a presidential candidate can run up margins in states that he wins that don't do him any good in states that he loses. If Al Gore could have taken a couple of hundred thousand votes that he got in California that he didn't need to defeat George W. Bush and placed him on the table in Florida, he'd be president. So you can run up the score, if you will, in the popular vote, but lose in those building blocks that get you to 270.
Well, and I guess this is a good time to address what we might call overrepresentation in the Electoral College. Fred, why are some states overrepresented?
One reason why they are overrepresented is just the fact that in some parts of our system, we've recognized that states as states are entitled to equal representation. The most obvious example of this is the United States Senate, where Wyoming, Delaware, and Vermont, and Alaska get the same number of senators as California, New York, Massachusetts, Texas, and others. So there's that component brings about some degree of overrepresentation, even though it is tempered by the popular component of it that involves adding the number of members of the House of Representatives to the number of members of the Senate. There's also, as John said, the potential overrepresentation that may come from differential margins in different states and the fact that the Constitution does not tell the states how they should choose or apportion their electoral votes. As John says, Maine and Nebraska have something close to a proportional system. All of the other states have what we call winner-take-all, what the Europeans call first-past-the-post. The other 48 states could change if they wanted, consistent with the Constitution. So it may be important to distinguish the structural features that are constitutionally mandated, in particular adding the number of senators to the number of representatives, from those forms of potential overrepresentation that are a function of different methods of deciding for each state who's going to get the number of electoral votes that the Constitution leaves to the individual states.
Let's move to some of the arguments for the Electoral College, and I'd like to have you comment on these. First one is that it contributes to the cohesiveness of the country by requiring a distribution of popular support to be elected president. John, would you like to comment on that?
I think that was true when the Electoral College was created, and it's something that forced presidential candidates to generate support across the country, in not just in the most populous areas. I do think in 21st century America, where the whole world is smaller and certainly the country is much smaller, our communications have people in constant touch with one another, that is a less relevant characteristic. It is probably not the most compelling argument for keeping the Electoral College.
Another argument for the Electoral College is that and this is an interesting one, that it contributes to the political stability of the nation by encouraging a two-party system. And I say it's interesting because certainly one of the arguments against the Electoral College system is that no third party or independent candidate is able to gain electoral votes. And we saw this with Ross Perot, who gained 19% of the popular vote but not one Electoral College vote. So, John, how would you respond to the argument that the Electoral College contributes to the political stability of the nation by encouraging a two-party system?
Well, I think that's probably a true argument. You could call it the stability of the system, or you could also call it the hegemony of the Democratic and Republican parties. Either way, it is true that denying electoral votes, which ultimately is the currency by which presidential campaigns are decided in a formal sense, you do discourage creation and growth of third-party organizations.
Yes, certainly. Whether this makes for more or less stability is one thing, but certainly, as John said, what we might want to call the centralizing tendencies of a two-party system without strong party discipline are reasonably obvious. And then we should think about what the real issue is. Is the country well served by a political system that is inclined to, as our statistics friends would say, cut off the tails of the distribution, to put it somewhat more bluntly, a political system in which, to use a football metaphor, everything is played between the 40-yard lines. It's not entirely clear that that's a good thing. It's not entirely clear that it produces a certain kind of desirable stability. But that's, to me, is really the issue, rather than just the small manifestation of it that is the Electoral College.
Finally, the last argument is that it maintains a federal system of government and representation, reserving important political powers to the component states. Would either of you like to add something?
There's no question that it does accomplish that purpose. The question is whether the American people see that as a relevant objective at this time in our history.
Well, and John, you know, you've certainly got your finger on the pulse of the political pulse of the nation. What do we need to have, a national dialogue?
Well, people who favor reform of the system want a national dialogue. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton proposed abolishing the Electoral College after the 2000 election. You have certain prominent forces in public life. The New York Times editorial board recently wrote an editorial saying abolish the Electoral College. It's a very, very difficult thing to make happen. Think about how difficult it was to reform, say, the campaign finance laws, and that just required an act of Congress. Getting a measure through Congress, both houses of Congress with a two-thirds vote, and then through three-quarters of the states is an exceedingly high hurdle. I think it is much less likely that that's going to happen anytime soon than that you will see a mushrooming of attempts to change scattered places where it will advantage one part or the other to change the state apportionment of those votes rather than a sweeping fix.
You're listening to The Electoral College, Democracy Gained or Lost. I'm Kathleen Sabo with Professor Frederick Schauer of the University of Virginia Law School and journalist John Harwood, Chief Washington Correspondent for CNBC and a writer for The New York Times. We turned our attention next to a discussion of common arguments against the Electoral College. The possibility of electing a minority president And what are the merits of that argument? Why is that problematic?
I'm not sure it is. We've elected minority presidents. We elected one in 1992, another one in 1996. Same guy, it was Bill Clinton. He never got 50% of the vote. And it happened with George W. Bush in 2000.
Thinking of a non-majority president as problematic assumes, in a way, the conclusion. It assumes the conclusion that this is a national office. It is a popular office. That's something the people ought to be thinking about and debating.
Mm. Another argument against the Electoral College is the role it plays in depressing voter turnout. Is this a legitimate argument, John Harwood?
It is certainly true that in states that are solidly in the Republican column, let's take Idaho, neither party is going to run as aggressive a get-out-the-vote operation as they are in, say, Ohio. Same right. with the Democrats in a state like Massachusetts. So to that extent, yes, it could be seen as having an adverse effect on turnout. On the other hand, that's not very consequential, doesn't really advantage one side or the other. And I think Fred's right. If you went to a uniform system, both voter turnout efforts and the targeting of the advertising and the visits by various candidates would have different effects in different places.
Next argument is that the Electoral College fails to accurately reflect the national popular will. Is this a problem?
Well, it's certainly true that it fails to reflect the popular will, and we saw that as evidence in the 2000 election. But, you know, the Constitution defined the popular will in a particular way, and the particular way it defined the popular will was a combination, in effect, of the wishes of the people as people and the states as states, as Fred said earlier. So it's really a definitional question. We do have a Republican small r system rather than a purely direct Democratic system, and that's reflected in the Electoral College.
Right. And, I mean, the failures are there under one definition of the popular will, but even under that definition of the popular will, the United States Senate, especially given its filibuster and cloture rules, is far more frustrating of the popular will than the Electoral College.
One thing we haven't spoken about is what happens should there be a tie in the Electoral College, and the election is then thrown into the House of Representatives with each delegation having one vote. So one of the arguments against the Electoral College is that throwing the election into the House of Representatives is undemocratic. It's not consistent with one person, one vote. John, how would you respond to that argument?
Well, certainly the quote, undemocratic features of the system are much magnified if you get to an election in the House of Representatives, because then California votes with the same weight as Idaho does and Delaware and Maine. That is grossly out of proportion with the people's will, as it were. But that is the system that the framers put in place. And the fortunate thing for the country is that that's pretty unlikely to happen. Not impossible, but unlikely.
Right. And if you will allow me to be constitutionally pedantic for a moment, it is important to note that the system that you've just described, according to the Constitution, is the system for electing the president in the case of a tie, but not for electing a vice president in the case of a tie. In the case of a tie, the vice president is elected by the Senate.
Why is it that we continue to hold on to this federalist notion of the importance of states above maybe perhaps all else, when we seem to have moved away from it in a lot of other areas, for instance, in the areas of education, where now the national government has a large say in how the states and what the states have to do with regard to education and the No Child Left Behind Act? Why are we still holding on to that?
Well, there are a number of other areas in which the states still play the dominant role. Most of the criminal law and law enforcement in the United States is at the state level. Most of the law regarding marriage, divorce, and the family is at the state level. And in numerous other ways, states continue to play a significant role. Whether that's appropriate or not is something else again. Whether it is appropriate that the divisions be demarcated the way they were demarcated a few hundred or more years ago is something else again. But we certainly have a governmental system in which states, their government, their money, their taxes, their governors, their legislatures play a significant role.
I was going to say, let's don't forget, one reason why we hang on to the system is it's pretty hard to change the Constitution. There was a movement in the late 60s, early 70s to do this, and it passed the House, didn't go anywhere in the Senate. So even if you have an idea that seems consistent with the times, that seems to have the wind of public opinion behind it, getting from there to a constitutional amendment that would remove that in effect, reweighting of the vote to augment the power of smaller states, that's very, very hard to do.
Right. The just as a refresher, the amendment process requires a two-thirds vote in both houses and then ratification by the legislatures of three-quarters of the states. That two-thirds plus two-thirds plus three-quarters of the states is extraordinarily difficult. Less than a majority of the legislators in only 13 states can block a constitutional amendment, which makes it very hard. We've only amended the Constitution 27 times in our history, and 10 of those came all at once. This happens very rarely. The more important it is, the less likely it is to happen these days.
To the best of your knowledge, Fred Schauer and John Harwood, whenever we have exported democracy, helped to form a democratic government or helped to develop a constitution, have we exported the Electoral College?
Virtually not at all. We actually, and this could be another show, we've done far less exporting than people think, and at times far less successful exporting than we have tried to do. But certainly if we look for a dominant international model, both in countries that have been around for some time and in newly emerging or newly transitioning countries, the something closer to a parliamentary model is far more dominant than something that looks like the U.S. We haven't even tried to do much exporting of the basic structural idea of the American Constitution, fearing, I think correctly, that it is both so old and so historically contingent that other countries would either not be interested or it wouldn't work in other countries or both.
If you ask most Americans about the Electoral College, they can't describe how it works. If you ask them if they'd support a system that may not honor the popular vote, most seem to oppose it. Is this an effective argument against the Electoral College?
It's an argument for how people understand the presidency. And I think in a democracy, people are entitled to say, if they want to say, we do not understand the presidency in terms of states. We understand the Senate in terms of states, but we understand the presidency in terms of something much more majoritarian. That's certainly a plausible thing for even a federal country to decide to do.
John, comment?
I agree with that.
Well, let's go through quickly just a list of some of the proposals for changing our system. So the first proposal for change that we already spoke about was changing the winner-take-all system and perhaps going to the district system that Maine and Nebraska have. It's true, is it not, that this would not take a constitutional amendment? This is a change that would take place in the state legislatures?
States could affect those changes, except that requiring every state to do it would require a constitutional change.
And John, how about when you use the district system that gives electors based on the popular vote within the state and the rest based on the districts? How would that 2000 election have turned out? Are you aware?
Yes, it would have resulted in an increased electoral majority for George W. Bush. Because he carried most of the congressional districts, and he also carried more states than Al Gore did. If, on the other hand, you did an award of votes based purely on the popular vote, well, we know who got more popular votes. That was Al Gore.
Let's move to that choice, which is a pure popular vote. Constitutional amendment required?
Yes, it would, because you still have the augmented power of states as states, even if states went to a proportional system on their own. To get away from the extra two votes that everybody gets for representing the two Senate seats, that would take the Constitution to be changed.
Yes.
Okay, here's another proposal, which is to assign electoral votes by number of representatives only. And again, John, you just spoke to this, but constitutional change?
Yes, it would require a change in the Constitution.
You know, some of the other proposals for change are a popular vote with a runoff election, a weighted or preferential popular vote, a preferential electoral vote, a runoff election in case of a statistical tie. And we don't need to go into detail about those. But, John, which of those proposals for change that we have mentioned do you feel has the best chance for being successfully implemented?
I think the best chance for changing the Electoral College system being implemented is state by state, interested parties generating either through legislatures and governors or through the initiative and referendum process, generating a change in those state allocations of votes, because that would obviate the need to get a federal constitutional amendment, which is very, very hard to do.
Is it time for us to take those steps, do you feel?
I don't have a firmly held position on that. I can see the arguments on both sides, and I really think a lot of the impulse on this depends on which side is the loser in the electoral colleges compared to the popular vote. There was a lot of speculation before the 2000 election that Al Gore might be the person who would win an electoral majority but lose the popular vote, since Republicans typically run up large margins in small states where Democrats don't even contest. What's happened, though, is Democrats have become so strong in the state of California that they now have a structural advantage in the popular vote, and that's why we had the outcome we did. But I think how much impulse there is for change depends on who comes out the loser under the system.
And a full discourse about all of this would at least have to consider the possibility that the historical entrenchment of what may be a pretty bad idea, if unentrenched, might lead to some number of proposals being enacted in some states that would turn out to be even worse.
Could turn out to be the political equivalent of the designated hitter.
Right.
And Fred, it sounds like you're cautioning us as a constitutional scholar not to act in any haste with regard to this issue.
Although the people on either side of this issue should not be immediately dismissed as morons, there are arguments on both sides. I would be comfortable with a serious, engaged national debate on this issue. At this level, you're no longer talking about constitutional law. You're talking about larger questions of political design in a democracy, as to which constitutionalists might have something to say, but let's not assume that we have too much to say.
Our thanks to John Harwood, Chief Washington Correspondent for CNBC and a writer for the New York Times, and Frederick Schauer, the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia Law School. The Electoral College, Democracy Gained or Lost, has been produced by Paul Ingalls and Kathleen Sabo, engineered by Paul Ingalls with assistance from Tristan Klum. Support for this program has been provided by the Independent Producers Fund at KUNM at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. You can hear this program again online at goodradioshows.org. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. Thanks for listening. See you at the polls.